Welcome back to Podcast Recovery, everyone. We are your hosts, David O.
And Eric V.
Today we are joined by Sandra. How are you doing today?
I'm doing good. Thank you for asking.
Absolutely. Where are you from, Sandra?
I am in South Florida.
South Florida.
Oh, I'm living here, but from a different part of the country, so.
Where are you from in the country?
Originally from New Mexico.
Oh, okay. You're a ways away.
Yeah.
All right. And when were you first introduced to recovery?
My first introduction to recovery was in July of 2017.
All right. And how long have you been sober?
Almost 2 years. I will, if I continue to work day by day, we'll have 2 years on July 27, 2017.
All right, that's awesome. And with all that out of the way, I'm going to turn it over to you to share your story with us, so take it away.
All right. Well, for me, getting introduced into recovery a little bit less than 2 years ago really just turned my life around and really just let me understand that this disease, the disease of addiction, whatever it may be, just can get anybody at any time. And after a little bit with, where a little bit about my childhood, as we often hear about, just to have an understanding of where I came from. I grew up in a small town in New Mexico to immigrant parents. We were poor, but I really didn't realize it, so I think that was a blessing. Mm-hmm. My father was an alcoholic for as long as my whole life he's been an alcoholic, mm-hmm. and still is. He was not really abusive physically, but he was emotionally abusive. He could go weeks and weeks without talking to us and just not a really nice man. Yeah. I remember at one point, I know a lot of people can relate. Mm-hmm. When I was in high school, somebody came to my house and said he had totaled the car. And I remember asking, is the car okay? And they told me no. And, you know, it took me a while. And I remember having that thought, which is hard for me to even realize now, that I had wished he was dead. So that was somebody I didn't want to become.
Yeah.
And here I am 4 decades later. Mm-hmm. So it really has been quite a journey. My mom was emotionally unavailable too. She was codependent, and she really didn't offer that love and support. To make things funner, my older sister and my younger brother are both bipolar, and so there was a lot of dysfunction, and I mean that's everywhere, but there was a lot of dysfunction and just not a whole lot of. Well, I don't know what normal is. It's normal, but if there is normality, I don't know what it was.
Yeah.
So I remember not being a happy child. And I remember at one point even thinking, why do I exist? And, you know, when I think back on the childhood, I don't remember anything happy. When my younger brother was born, he was 9 years younger than me, being from a Hispanic family. They always wanted the boy. So he was the golden child. And I was kind of just left to my own, which when people ask me how I ended up normal in my family, I say it's because I'm a normal middle child and I left the state. So, but you know, that was just my life and how things worked out for me.
Mm-hmm.
So grew up in a household where my dad was angry and mean. He would not speak to us. He would leave and not come back. He didn't trust me. Mm-hmm. I was, somewhat of a goody two-shoes all through high school. You know, he went to my honor society induction and told me that I probably wasn't even a part of it. Of course, he was drunk, which, you know, was devastating to me as a 16-year-old girl.
Yeah.
And then my mom, like I said, was not emotionally available. And all she would ever say is, why don't you wear more makeup? Why don't you dress better? Why don't boys like you? So I really, like so many others, didn't feel good enough. I didn't feel loved. I didn't feel good enough.
Yeah.
I didn't feel worthy. And so I left. I went to college, and I think I had it planned ever since I was in high school that I would just grow up, leave. And that very first night when I was finally free and independent, because I was not going to become my dad or my mother,
mm-hmm.
I decided I was going to go and get drunk. So I can still remember it now. I was at what ended up being one of our favorite hangout spots in the big city of Albuquerque.
Mm-hmm.
Say that. and I was drinking, it's very ironic, but vodka, my first and last drink, out of a cup in the restaurant. And I remember saying, I think I'm drunk, and being happy, instantly happy. And it was probably going away, being free.
Yeah.
And that really started my life for the next 10 years, because I did go to school and get education for 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
My double life started then. I would about Friday at 5 start drinking and partying with my friends until Sunday when I recovered, and then I would study Sunday night through Friday afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
So my group of study friends didn't believe that I drank, and my group of drinking friends didn't believe that I was smart or could get good grades.
Yeah.
And that was what happened for the next, I actually was in school for 10 years. And, you know, it was that I have to be really good at everything.
Mm-hmm.
But then I would, I deserve a drink because I could unwind. I can talk to people because mm-hmm. I could never talk to people without alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it worked for me, but ever since the very first drink, I drank to blackout.
Yeah.
And I could never just have one drink, which I didn't realize it before 2 years ago, but now looking back, I'm like, oh yeah, it was never one drink, and it was always to blackout. People could,
yep.
If I was missing, then yeah, I was in the bathroom by a toilet, passed out. So one thing that was interesting was when I was in college, I had a lot of friends that were using other substances, and you know, they always would ask me, do you want anything? And mm-hmm. I always remember saying, no, if I do anything else, I will end up in rehab or killing myself.
Mm.
And it was strange that I couldn't put alcohol with that.
Yeah.
You know, and my college roommate did end up in rehab after her first year. And I knew it could have been me, but I didn't put the pieces together that alcohol could do the same thing to me as any other drug. And it just took probably a little bit longer than what would have happened then.
Mm-hmm.
So I finished my life, and I really needed to find myself first, of course, because I still wasn't able to love myself and all of that stuff. So I put everything into my career, into getting married, into having children, and really put all of my self-worth into everything else. I had a really successful career. I had reached every milestone that I had really wanted to reach.
Mm.
I was able to not drink during my pregnancy, so fortunately. So I had two healthy, wonderful little boys. Nice. And really throughout, let's see, the 10 years after I finished college and everything, and I guess it was a total of 24 years that I drank. So for about 12 years, I would drink on weekends.
Mm-hmm.
I would live my life. And of course I couldn't have a problem because I was successful. People would say, well, you have it all. I'm mm-hmm. like, well, it depends on how you define it. But in my life, I figured I really did feel blessed and felt like I do have everything I could possibly want, and I couldn't be happier. And then this alcohol just started sneaking up on me a little bit more and more.
Mm-hmm.
I never really learned how to cope with difficult situations or learn relaxation skills outside of, let me just drink.
Mm-hmm.
And it really didn't seem like a big problem. Looking back, I do see that there were a lot of times that I would get angry or emotional or aggressive.
Mm-hmm.
Early on in my marriage, there were two instances where I did hit my husband, and he said if I ever did that again, that he would leave me. So I didn't do that again.
Yeah.
I don't blame it on the alcohol, but I was drinking. And so I know that even though I was lucky to not have a lot of consequences throughout those 20 some years,
mm-hmm.
that I did have a progressive drinking problem.
Yeah.
So fast forward to, it really was in 2015, and I've had some time to really reflect on everything that happened, and I never really blamed one incident on what happened,
mm-hmm.
Why my alcoholism progressed. I know it would have happened And I was fortunate that it did when it did, and I didn't have any of the big consequences, any of the big yet. My biggest blessing is that I never hurt anybody, mm-hmm. including my children.
Yeah.
Because there were instances that I could have hurt them, and that I struggle with sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And I shouldn't, but I still struggle with how could I be so irresponsible and drink and drive with the two individuals in this world I love more than anything else.
Mm-hmm.
So that part is still a little hard for me. So in 2015, I got a new position. It was my dream job. I was doing great. I did take on the weight of the world with that job. But then I also thought, well, I need to be the perfect mom. So I need to be at every single practice, every single school event. I needed to do everything in my job. I needed to be the perfect wife. Mm-hmm. And there's only so many hours in the day. I also have a chronic illness that causes a lot of pain. And so in order to keep up that speed, I needed to numb my pain.
Yeah.
And first it wasn't my emotional pain, it was my physical pain.
Yeah.
So every night I would start with, oh, let me just have a little glass of vodka so that I could get rid of the pain and I could sleep because, oh my gosh, well, I deserve it. I mm-hmm. did this, and that, and this is my reward. And every night I would have some, and it would turn into a little bit more.
Yeah.
And then it would turn into a little bit earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And then I noticed I was sneaking it. I'd be like, I'll get the drinks and drink about double of what I would give my husband. And it was just starting to progress more and more and more. But I thought I had it under control because I was still doing everything I was supposed to be doing, supposed to in mm-hmm. life. But I was, and the alcohol was helping me get through because I worked such long hours that at night when the kids would be asleep, that little bit of drinking
mm-hmm.
would give me the energy I would need to keep going 3 or 4 more hours.
Yeah.
And then, of course, I couldn't fall asleep, so then I could use it to sleep.
Mm-hmm.
And then I started having some personal situations, probably because I was always drinking at night, and I thought, oh, well, maybe I can handle these situations at work better if I have, if I drink before meetings.
Mm-hmm.
Not thinking that, you know, that's a problem.
Yeah.
You have to go into a meeting. And I remember having a few meetings where, and people said, are you okay? Are you drunk? It was a 9 o'clock meeting. And I'm like, no, I'm fine. And that, I think, was the day that I went to the liquor store in the morning to buy alcohol before going to work was the turning point. And I can't really picture when it was. It was sometime late 2016, early 2017.
Mm-hmm.
And even though the alcoholism was just progressing and progressing and progressing,
mm-hmm.
it just took off. I mean, from 2015 to 2017, it was quick. And I think that's really what got me our family, my immediate family, me and my husband, just shocked that it seemed as though I was okay.
Mm-hmm.
And within 2 years, I was nearly killing myself with the alcohol.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. So it started to become where I was pretty much drinking around the clock. A lot of it was that I was so physically dependent on it.
Mm-hmm.
I would be shaking.
Yeah.
I'd wake up in the morning, and as soon as I could hold any alcohol down, I would just start drinking. I thought that I was able to manage it where I could just keep it at a certain level,
mm-hmm.
and then so I could still drive.
Oh,
and then, you know, once I got home, oh, yeah, of course, right?
Mm-hmm.
I can just, like, I would buy the little bottles.
It's because that, yeah,
then
it's that sweet spot.
Yeah.
Just right where I can function right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't have the shakes. I'm not irritable. I can function. I can drive. And then once I'd get home, all bets were off.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
You know, there were so many nights that the fighting was insane in the family, and I never remembered them. I started to try to take notes, but I couldn't even make sense of my notes on my phone. My kids, I would put them to sleep and pass out, and then I'd ask them something, and they'd say, well, we told you that yesterday. And I'd be like, oh, of course. or I was really on edge by the time I got home because I had to have that drink. Yeah. And if I didn't have that drink, then it was so bad that they would go to practice. I would go to the liquor store, get something, you know, just enough to get me through their practice, mm-hmm. and then get home. And if I didn't have anything at home that would be noticed, then I would stop. And one time it was so bad, I took them to the liquor store and told them to wait in the car. And they were like, well, where are we going? I said, oh, it's a drink store. And they're like, oh, can we have Gatorade? And so I get them Gatorade and I get my stuff. And I'm just like, great. Now they're always going to want to go to the drink store to get Gatorade. And I'm like, what am I doing? Mm. Wow. So there were a few times that I tried to stop drinking because, well, obviously it was a problem, but my blood pressure was so out of control. Like, I could have had a stroke. I mean, I'm talking like 180 over 90. I did go to the emergency room one day. I don't know how they didn't test to see if I was drunk. I don't know if it's just that you wouldn't assume somebody in their mid-40s. Mm-hmm. A middle-aged mother of two with a successful career, whatever that is, should be tested for alcoholism. And I think that's why this is so important to me, is that I hope it doesn't happen to other people in my situation.
Yeah.
I did get liver tests done, and they were really out of control. And I remember standing there looking at them and looking at my children, thinking, I need to stop, and nothing could get me to stop. Mm-hmm. So my husband did find out because I was doing the hiding the bottles and replacing them. And I had a bunch of bottles in my car that I was going to take to a garbage can because, you know, that's a totally normal thing to do.
Yeah.
And I knew where all the alcohol liquor stores were. I knew where all the garbage cans were. I knew it just took so much effort.
Yeah.
He did find out, and he just thought, I think he believed me for a while, and I know he felt a lot of guilt thinking that he didn't catch it early enough, and I tell him there's nothing he could have done. Mm-hmm. I did go into recovery in July, in about early July, on our anniversary weekend. I was drunk all day. He took me to dinner and I couldn't even make it through. I don't remember really what happened.
Mm-hmm.
A year later, he took me back and he was like, well, we have the same waitress. And he was like, do you remember anything? And I have no clue what happened.
Yeah.
That night he did ask me, do you have a problem with alcohol? And I said, no. I stayed up all night, and at 7 in the morning, I woke him up and I said, yes, I have a problem. I'm an alcoholic. Mm. So we came up with these great plans. We were only going to drink on weekends. We were only going to have beer or wine. Yeah. I sound familiar. Yeah. We even thought maybe we'll just smoke pot. Alcohol will just not be part of our story.
Mm-hmm.
So it was like, okay, great. We got a plan. I did okay for a few days, and then we were going to go on a vacation the week before I went into rehab. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how, but he went to pick up the kids and came back, and we were leaving around noon, and I was already drunk. And I think I had drank the day before and woke up and just started drinking again.
Yeah.
And before he went to get the kids, he said, if you're not ready to go when I get back, I'm leaving you. And so I packed my bag as fast as I could. It was really funny because I took my Halloween Superwoman shirt and I got to the place and I'm like, I have nothing to wear. I was like, go past it. It was probably a drunk one. We went on the trip and we talked a lot. And I told him, you know, I don't know what it is, but when I take, and this was all before anything with recovery, but I told him, when I have that first drink, I cannot stop.
Mm-hmm.
And so I said, okay, I'll get back. And when I can get around to it, I'll go to AA. And yeah, that didn't work.
Mm-hmm.
So we got back on a Monday night and, we decided that we would have a beer because I still had a lot of withdrawal symptoms. And I remember waiting for him to fall asleep, and I hit the liquor cabinet. And that began my last drunk, and it was a three-day drunk. It was a three-day drunk. Yeah. I remember I had quit driving to get alcohol at that point because I had a close call where I actually bumped into a car with my kids in the car. I was completely, I would be in jail and they would have been taken away from me.
Yeah.
And the lady I hit, her wife, she was the wife of a cop.
Oh no.
And the only reason that she didn't stop to call the cop was because she was late for something. And so I met her husband and paid cash to fix their car. So my husband wouldn't know and nothing would be figured out. And that at that point, I quit drinking and driving. But I walked everywhere those 3 days to get alcohol. I must have tried to ride a bike because when I went into rehab, it felt like I had a broken rib and I had crusts all over. I don't know what happened, but
yeah,
it's kind of sometimes a blessing when you don't remember.
Drinking and bicycling is probably worse than drinking and driving. It never ends well.
Yeah, it probably was.
Like, you can get lucky in a car. You're not getting lucky with a bicycle.
That's true, but I could only hurt myself in a bicycle. But what would possess me to ride a bike is beyond me. But I did have, like, a huge gash on my leg that looked like the pedal. So I'm like, okay. And my butt bone hurt really, really bad. So I don't know what happened, but I probably am glad I don't know. From those 3 days, from Monday until Thursday morning, what I do remember is the night before, I remember there being cops at our house. I don't know why. I haven't asked why. Mm-hmm. I just remember I was sitting on the floor and the lady was saying, "You need help." And I was crying and I was saying, "I know." And I remember the horrible fights telling my husband that all he wanted to do was take the children from me. Mm. I mean, it was insanity.
Yeah.
He later told me that it was so bad that if he left me alone at any point in that last 24 hours, I would run to where we keep all the alcohol and drink as much as I could. Mm-hmm. And so he ended up having to lock me in our bedroom and put the house alarm on, so that if I came out of the room, he could at least stop me from pretty much drinking myself to death. Because mm-hmm. by the time I got into rehab, my blood alcohol content, even after like 12 hours, was still above legal limit. So I don't know what would have happened if he hadn't have locked me in the room and taken mm-hmm. me to rehab. So that next morning, me being angry, throwing things at him, yelling, screaming, he took me in mm-hmm. to for detox and rehab. I remember the look on my son's face, like, "Who are you?
Ooh.
What have you done? Why are you like this?" And I remember what my husband told me. He said, "I will not let our children hate you the way you hate your dad. Mm. And I won't let them resent me the way you resent your mom." Mm. And, you know, it's taken me like a year and a half to understand when I'm like, I didn't have to get what was it was that keeps me working so hard to be sober every day, one day at a time. And it's those words he said to me, and it was like, wow, I have become what I never wanted to become.
Yeah.
And so that was the story. I can start talking about the solution. I didn't mean to be in the problem for so long, but
How was it like getting out of rehab and like starting to go to like fellowship? Like what happened in rehab? Like that really made you change.
Okay, so I don't know what it was. But within, you know, he left, I didn't want to speak to him. He was gone. Within 4 hours, he was trying to get a hold of me for some reason.
Mm-hmm.
And all I remember saying is, "Tell him thank you." And so I think I knew how bad it was. Mm-hmm. And what I did in rehab and in those first 28 days is I listened and I tried to be willing. And I remember what I was so, it was such a dark and hopeless place. And my whole life I had always felt depressed, but mm-hmm. I was so depressed. Of course, you know, again, I'm like, how did this happen?
Mm-hmm.
And it does. It is part of who I am and my life and my journey. Somebody came in from one of the recovery programs
mm-hmm.
and was talking about her story. And I remember that was the first time I ever felt hope that I could actually be sober. Mm-hmm. And it was hard. You know, we had to tell my kids that I was away. First, my husband said vacation. I'm like, I went on vacation without them.
Mm-hmm.
so So we said I had to go away for work. And the older one had a lot of questions when I came back and was not happy about it. The younger one was a little more clueless. Right now they're 10 and 8, so they were about 8 and 6.
Mm-hmm.
But during treatment, I listened and, you know, heard the, it wasn't easy every day, but heard the message of join a fellowship, do 90 meetings in 90 days, get mm-hmm. a sponsor, or to do all of these steps.
Yeah.
To call people, to put sobriety first before mm-hmm. anything in your life.
Yeah.
And that sounded really strange to me because nothing was more important than my children. Mm-hmm. And I was like, well, except for alcohol.
Yeah.
So those 28 days happened. I don't know when the obsession was lifted, but to me, it was, and to me, that just, aside from the entire story and aside from everything that I went through without really ever getting hurt myself, because I did some really stupid things where I could have been assaulted or hurt or,
oh, yeah.
you know, hurt myself, hurt somebody else, hurt mm-hmm. my children. I mean, when I look at all of that and I think, how did I get out of it or how was I protected for so long?
Mm-hmm.
I just know that there's something bigger than me,
mm-hmm.
That has always been there to guide me. And so that helped me a lot too in having that faith that there's something bigger than me, because if this obsession where I couldn't even stop running to get more alcohol or couldn't go to a place without thinking of drinking or wanting to drink.
Yeah.
And now I can be next to a keg of my favorite beer and it's revolves me. So I'm like, that has to be something bigger than me.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I came out, there was a lot of adjustment. I think the first 6 months was probably the worst time of our marriage.
Mm-hmm.
Because there was no trust, of course.
Yeah.
And I realized that he had to go through his own process and I had to be patient and understanding. And in the same time, focus on my recovery and staying sober every day. The relationship with the children was a little bit easier because they didn't understand anything.
Yeah.
And even now they're like, but you never drink. I'm just like, I don't drink. No. And they'll say like, if we go somewhere, are you going to have wine? I said, no, alcohol makes me very sick.
Mm.
And they're just like, okay. And when they're older, I will talk to them about it because it's in the family. And
mm-hmm.
I just want them to understand it and not be afraid of it and hopefully not repeat what I have in so many generations in my family.
Yeah.
One of, you know, so that first year was really hard. I didn't work a program the first 3 or 4 months, and I could see myself getting back into that isolation, back into that depression.
Yeah.
So I stalked somebody in a meeting and found who I wanted to be a sponsor and finally approached her. And fortunately, she has been a godsend and really has guided me through the steps, almost done with them the first mm-hmm. time through, and has really given me a lot of support in different challenges that have come up. But really it's taking it one day at a time,
mm-hmm.
And working a 12-step recovery program that has worked for me, over the past almost 2 years.
Yeah.
So one thing about the children that, and this is really where it was impactful in that I remember we were taking a walk for some reason and I used to call my cell phone Mommy Monster, and Mommy Monster needed to have her drink or else she would become a monster.
Yeah.
And out of nowhere, my oldest was like, you know what? Mommy Monster's gone. And I was like, yes, she is. And he said, we were really scared of her. She was scary.
Oof.
And I never thought that I had hurt them.
Yeah.
And all I said to him is, I work every day to make sure she doesn't come back.
Mm.
And he was like, okay. I said, but don't give me that. He said, I won't curse that. So, but I think it's all attributed to being able to work the 12 steps
mm-hmm.
In all of my affairs and really have tried to put it as my number one priority.
All right. Is that about it? Wrap it up? Is that good? You good?
I'm good.
All right. Well,
you guys good?
Yeah, we got some questions for you for sure. It was a great, great story.
All right. Absolutely.
All right. Eric, would you like to go first?
I'm first.
You're first.
Wow. Look at you over there.
No.
I'm deferring to you today.
All right. So this is kind of it's a similar question, but it kind of has two different parts to it. So I'm just kind of lumping them together. But you kind of described yourself as a weekend warrior earlier on. And also that you kind of had this outward persona of where everything was, perfect. You had the family, you had the great job, you had all of that stuff. How does, and you can answer these separately, but I feel like, at least from my perspective, the weekend warrior mentality kind of gives this false sense of control because you can stop during the week, but you're going hard on the weekend. And, from the other side of the outward, I don't know, when I'm paying my mortgage or, making my car payments, I'm not late on bills. It's hard to accept addiction. I guess for you, how did that distort your perception of your alcoholism?
Ooh.
Well, for so long, and even when I came out of treatment, I was like, I didn't have a problem until the last year. It was just this last year that I had an alcohol problem. And then I was listening in the rooms, and I started reflecting on my drinking from the first drunk all the way through, and I'm like, wait a minute, I drink to blackout every single time. I drink for every single feeling, every single emotion. And it distorted my view because I thought I am in control. I was, not my higher power, of my career, my life, my family, my drinking. I could control it all and I could take care of it all. And there is no way, knowing what I know and not wanting to become my father, that I could become an alcoholic. When I wasn't able to pay those bills, and sometimes it was because I would forget, or, so many of those nights that I would stay up working or paying bills or doing what I had to do, I would pass out at the computer and then wake up the next morning and be like, okay, what did I do yesterday? This was another thing that was really strange, is that I would, because I had a lot, it wasn't the job, but I had a lot of work. And so I'd come home and work 3, 4, 5 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And the next morning I'd be like, okay, I'm going to work on this project. And I pull it up and it'd be done. And I would be like, how'd that happen? And I'd read it and I'm like, damn, that's good. And I was like, oh, then I don't have a problem because I can even function when I'm not even remembering what I'm doing. So I really just felt like I had it all under control. And because I had this outward persona and everything around me looked like it was great. And, and I would get that from some people. And because deep down I was like, no, it's not. I was going through this depression. I was never happy. It was never enough. I thought, no, there's no way that I could become an alcoholic. And even that night I stayed up and admitted it to myself was difficult. I wasn't paying bills because sometimes I couldn't even write them. I was shaking so hard. Mm-hmm. I couldn't remember. I would have to travel for work. I would pass out at the airport and not make it to my meeting. So then I would have to buy a ticket for the next morning and try to get through a presentation with, I just have to down something, go give the talk, and then run out of there. I was an expensive drunk because I did that so many times. I screwed up so many times, but I always could fix it on my own without somebody finding out. And I was like, I don't have a problem. It wasn't until there towards the end where everything really was falling apart. My son was getting an MRI, and I was drunk off my ass sitting there waiting for him to come out of recovery and driving him home. And I'm like, something's not right here. And that really was when I started to think I need help, but really believing it and taking it fully in just happened when I was taken to rehab. And it isn't for everybody. For me, I think what it helped me was that 28 days to and they weren't letting me out, that's for sure.
Yeah.
It was too. It was like, and, there was one night that, you know, it was one of those that would drive us to a fellowship once a week. And the first one we went to, we passed right by my house.
Wow.
Into the store that I would actually, the store that I would always stop by and start and buy alcohol from. And, oh, that was painful.
Mm-hmm.
But I knew if I ran away from there, my husband would just send my ass right back over there. And mm-hmm. So I knew for me, if to drink, and I truly believe it, is to die. Because the only reason, my husband said the only reason he didn't leave me at home alone was because he was afraid I'd be dead when he got back, and he was having dreams that my children would find me dead. And knowing that it was so out of control that last time. But I don't know if that really answered your question, but yeah, there was this huge distortion that I could control it all and compartmentalize it, and mm-hmm. nothing was wrong.
Yeah.
Everything was great. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like, they used to tell me, how'd that work out?
Yeah. All right.
Not so good.
Well, it eventually worked out well, but like, at the time of active drinking, it's not so good.
Yeah.
But, all right, I got a question for you. So this is sort of like a nature versus nurture question I have. Like, a lot of people believe that regardless of how things, like, turn out, they are mm-hmm. just sort of born an addict, and it was, like, bound to happen sooner or later. And then there's a lot of people who have very rough upbringing, which sort of happened to be like a catalyst for their addiction.
Right.
And I have a follow up to this after you answer. So how much do you think it was just sort of in your genetics from the get go versus like how you were brought up and being exposed to alcoholism, like in your family?
You know, I've struggled with that one, and also because I do have, my family does have such a strong history of mental health problems.
Mm-hmm.
I really think you can be set up with your genetics, and then your environment is what can set the trigger. So
mm-hmm.
genetics cocks the gun, and then... But, you know, my childhood, you know, I make it sound like it was the worst one. It wasn't as bad as some people who never have problems.
Mm-hmm.
So I really do think I was born with, I guess, propensity or like, it. For me, I think it would have happened at some point in my life.
Mm-hmm.
From what I think I remember, they haven't found the genetic link, but when they talked about all the risks, I had every single one of them.
Yeah.
So I really think it is a combination of, you know, I was set up for it.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't remember like those same behaviors when I was younger,
mm-hmm.
but I had always had it in my mind that I would have a problem with addiction. I spoke a little bit about the chronic pain that I have,
mm-hmm.
and I made sure I never had opiates around. I just made sure I never had them around because I was terrified of becoming addicted. But not with alcohol. So I think I was genetically predispositioned,
mm-hmm.
and then just everything else was just what led it to it. And so when I think about it, and I think of my children, I think they're genetically predisposed to it because I come from a long family. Fortunately, it's only half.
Mm-hmm.
They're also genetically predisposed to all these mental illnesses. So even before the drinking, you know, I had always said I wanted to be that perfect mom. I'm far from perfect.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. But I try to be the mother to them, and I try to live in my recovery program to teach them how to know their self-worth,
mm-hmm.
know that it's okay to fail.
Yeah.
That one's hard, to let your child fail.
Mm-hmm.
And then when they start, you know, my son was watching a TV show and he's like, Mom, what's AA? And I was like, whoa, where'd you hear that from? And he's mm-hmm. like, oh, it was on TV. And then so I said, it's for people who can't drink, who, either get really sick or they just cannot drink. And he, mm-hmm. you know, he'll stop when he needs to, and then he'll ask more questions. And so as they grow up, I want them to know my story.
Yeah.
So that they can be aware of what could happen.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I can't ever prevent it, but, and I do see, like, my youngest is a perfectionist like me. And mm-hmm. so sometimes I'm like, you know, it's okay to not be perfect. And then I'm like, okay, I need to record that for myself.
Yep.
I work on that character flaw every single day. but yeah, I think it merges, and that happens with, you know, why didn't I end up with the same illness as my siblings did?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Maybe it was because I was a middle child.
Yeah.
Jim.
All right. That was perfect. That was a great answer.
Yeah.
And sort of my follow-up question is, you talked about, like, in the beginning of your, like, your drinking, you were sort of doing it as sort of like a freedom kind of moment. Like, you had gotten away from your parents. Mm-hmm. So you're like, hey, I can go drink now. And it seemed like that it was just sort of like social drinking. You were unwinding after class all week, blah, blah, blah. So how much of it, what did it, like, start as that social unwinding, and when, or did you ever realize that it, or think that it became sort of like a self-medication for how you were feeling?
In starting college, it was a couple of things. Some mm-hmm. of it was, but a lot of it was, it was my reward.
Mm-hmm.
I earned it. I worked hard. I earned it. A lot of it was also social. I didn't really know how to be social before college. I spent a lot of my years growing up alone.
Mm-hmm.
With a lot of music. I was never allowed to go anywhere or do anything, and so it helped me be social. I all of a sudden had a group of friends, and we had shared interests.
Mm-hmm.
But when I left, and it was normal, right? Isn't that what everybody did?
Yeah.
yeah. I mean, hey, I was doing great. I didn't end up in rehab. I don't think I have like two or three friends that I still am in contact with, because a lot of people just didn't make it through.
Yeah.
When I was in my professional program, it was different.
Mm-hmm.
I was one of the few drinkers, and so I had a reputation for being the lush. And, you know, that could have said something. Oh, wait, maybe there's a problem. But no. It wasn't me. It was everybody else. Everybody else was boring. Nobody else knew how to have fun.
Mm-hmm.
And they needed to lighten up. when it came to having to be an adult and having to do social things, I had so much social anxiety that I remember going to, like, receptions for work, and I would have to self-medicate beforehand
mm-hmm.
and make sure that I was relaxed enough with the alcohol. And that was pretty much, you know, if I had any kind of social event. So it really became this crutch where it was like, well, if I'm going to do this, I'm going to have to be sure that I'm relaxed and be able to cope with it. And then when I started having really difficult situations with coworkers, it was like, well, I need to let some of the steam off. I need to relax, or else I'm going to blow up at them.
Yeah.
And it just really became self-medicating and a crutch. And then it was just like, and then the addiction took over, and it was, just took over my life. And so now the social anxiety, even now, if I do something new for the first time,
mm-hmm.
I have so much anxiety. When I was in college, I would go to a lot of rock concerts, and I would love it.
Mm-hmm.
and now I go to concerts, and I went to one. Finally, that was the music I liked that reminded me of all the times I would go. And I was nearly in a panic attack. Of course, it was in a bar. I wasn't alone.
Yeah.
And I texted my sponsor. I told the people I was with, I'm having a lot of anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
If it gets too bad, I just have to leave. It wasn't an urge to drink, although that's all I could focus on was everybody drinking. And I just reminded myself, every time you do something new, this happens. The first time I went to a work reception, you know, I had a lot of anxiety. I got a glass of water and stayed there as long as I needed to and then left. And I was like, okay, I did it. And each time it gets easier. Mm-hmm. And that's been one of the amazing things about being in recovery is that I can do all these things that I didn't think I could do.
Yeah.
Without any substance. And
totally.
And sometimes it is hard, but it's been amazing. I feel like I'm part of society now, which I never really felt that. I feel like, you know, even with my children's sports team, my friend was laughing at me and she's like, you're talking to people. Cause she was one of the coaches when I was in the depths of my addiction.
Mm-hmm.
And she was telling another friend, she's like, she used to sit, you see that farthest spot away over there? That's where she would sit and she wouldn't talk to anybody. And she would even tell you, I don't talk to people. And she's like, and look at her now. Now she talks to everybody as well. It's like, oh, if only you knew. But
that's awesome.
I mean, there's so many, despite how I got here and how much hell we went through, the fact that it wasn't worse and the life that I have now is just like, okay, I understand the grateful recovering alcoholic. I don't say it yet.
Mm-hmm.
I understand it.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
All right.
Cool.
What you got, Eric?
So I've kind of been obsessed with triggers this week. My question is, because I don't know, my triggers have changed so much. The first time I ever came into recovery to now, it's totally different. But how has your triggers and reservations changed over the course of your recovery?
Great question. So initially, my triggers were, I think I mentioned that it was probably the toughest time of our marriage, even though I say it was even tougher than when I was drinking, but my husband may argue that, because of course I don't remember it. So when I first, like my first 6 months of recovery, my triggers were the negative emotions. So we would get into some brutal fights, and I would think I need something to calm me down, or I have anxiety at work, and I'd be like, okay, I could use a drink right now to just relax. And fortunately, I was so mad at my husband that I'm like, I'm not going to drink at you. You're not worth it. So if that's what got me through, that's what got me through. If he was not worth my recovery. So, but I do have to say that he has been an amazing supportive husband, so we were fortunate to get through a lot of that. But now I find that I have a trigger is when I'm happy. So we went to see my brother-in-law got married, and he's like my brother, and I was at the bar and I was like, it would be nice to have a drink, and I was like, well, I don't have a drink. So I'm not. And I remember when they were doing the toast, and I was alone at the table, or I was a little bit behind everybody, and I looked at the champagne that somebody had left because I had gotten something else, and I thought, nobody would know.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know,
I've had that same thought at weddings. Exact same thought.
And that was, nobody would know, right?
Because it's always just sitting there. Yeah. Some idiot just left it on the table, and you know exactly what it is when you're looking at that glass, and you're just like,
exactly.
Who the hell would know? My sponsor's not here. Nobody from recovery's here.
Right.
I'm cool. I could do this. I could get away with it.
Yeah.
And then that alarm bell goes off, and you're like, wait, nope, don't do that. That's stupid. Go away. Go talk to somebody.
Yeah. So I'll like get a hold of my sponsor. I think that time my son had my phone, so I was like, crap. So what I did was and then of course I'm like, champagne, that's my favorite. I'm like, what wasn't your favorite? Like, it didn't matter what it was. And I played the tape through, and I remember what had happened, and I'm like, I'll know. And so I went and grabbed my phone and was able to past that. But I do find that now it's when I'm happy and, you know, everybody's celebrating. When I'm upset and I don't have that many triggers, but it's when things are great, and I heard that a lot in the room, that it's when things are great that you can be caught off guard. So somebody had given some good advice at one point that stuck with me was, if you're going through a really hard time or a really good time, you really have to work your program hard both of those times, because you don't want to get triggered by something. And so when I start feeling that, like, it would be nice, or I wish I could, I know that I need to start going to some more meetings or doing more things to make sure that I can have that thought pass, because they're going to happen. And that's, you know, the first time it happened, I was beating myself up, and somebody's like, you're an alcoholic, you're going to think about drinking.
Yeah.
Like, oh, okay. Just don't do it. And of course, you know, it's everywhere. You know, I'll go to the baseball games. We go to kids' parties. It's absolutely everywhere. And so if I have that feeling, I was taught, check my intention for being there. So I did go to a concert by myself, and I was like, why are you going? And I was like, because I want to listen to some good music like I used to. I pray. And I call my sponsor before and after, and I have an exit plan. So,
nice.
Cool. One day at a time.
Yeah. All right. I got one.
Yeah.
You said,
all right,
in your story that you didn't really identify alcohol as a drug. You sort of like all everything that was around you, those were the drugs. So my question isn't really like directly like personal. It's more like your opinion. Is that sort of what makes alcohol and alcoholism kind of more dangerous? Is that it's socially acceptable? Is that you can have alcohol at sporting events and weddings and all these places? There's liquor stores everywhere, and it just seems to be socially acceptable, especially in America. Like, it's like you said, you're happy, you're having a good time, it's 4th of July, you drink, it's Christmas party, it's the Christmas party, you drink. So
yeah,
how dangerous is alcohol because it's socially acceptable? And do you think it needs to be identified more publicly as a drug?
I think it does. I think, and what I had noticed even going through it and then especially afterwards is how much it's marketed to certain demographics, like, I mean, they came out, and I've read a lot, not a lot, but I've read about it, how they, you know, specifically market things to women, and I notice a lot more, and it is socially acceptable. There are so many things, I can't go to a kid's birthday party. My nephew had his first birthday party, I think it was 3-4 months in, and there was a full bar. I mean, full bar.
First birthday?
Oh, yeah.
First year birthday party.
Yeah. When all my nieces were having their, like, first, second, third birthdays, like, all the parents are getting wasted. All of them. Like, and that's when I was still using, so I was getting wasted with my sister. And it's like, it's almost like the kid's birthday becomes completely secondary to, like, playing horseshoes and cornhole and all the adults drinking. And then eventually you have
kids. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I love taking the kids to the birthday parties, let me tell you. It was like, we have a birthday party, I'll take them. And I would go straight to wherever the drinks were and, you know, just have enough to be able to drive them home. And it is socially acceptable. And it is, fortunately, I haven't gotten a whole lot of, why aren't you drinking? Because, you know, of course, I think everybody knows what I'm doing all the time. And I was like, when... I no longer have that job, but when I had that job, those first few years, I was a social director. So, I mean, we'd have our executive meetings and take shots of alcohol in the meetings at 10 o'clock in the morning. I mean, I knew at least four places in my workplace. It was a small workplace. We only had 25 people where I could get anything I wanted because it was just part of, it was just part of the culture. It was,
yeah.
there was a lot of drinking going on. And so when I came back and my boss didn't know where I was and my very close friends, that culture didn't stop. Mm-hmm. You know, we'd have our Thanksgiving luncheon and, oh, well, here are all the shots.
Yeah.
It's like, okay. Or, you know, it was good to have people who knew because they were like, okay, here's your drink and not make a big deal about it. But mm-hmm. It is really socially acceptable. And I like one of the recovery programs that says alcohol is a drug.
Yes.
And I think there just needs to be a lot more awareness. And then the other part that I found that is really difficult is the stigma around any kind of addiction. I think worked against me because I said I couldn't possibly be an alcoholic. I couldn't possibly mm-hmm. be like my dad or yeah. I have everything under control and it sneaks up.
Yeah, because that's sort of like mm-hmm. the other side of that coin. On one side of the coin, it's socially acceptable. But then on the other side of that coin, mm-hmm. there's the stigma of being an alcoholic.
Yeah.
So it's really it's really kind of a
brown bagging, like, guy walking down, like,
yeah, there's a juxtaposition of culture and society with America that it's like, oh, yeah, drinking's cool. And then it's like, drinking too much is not cool.
Right, but it's also that sloppy drunk, so, you know, it's like, I hear people say, well, yeah, maybe you shouldn't drink so much because, you know, a few times, probably more than a few times, I did get out of control, but yeah, it's that, well, it's socially acceptable to drink and to do X, Y, and Z, but then if you have a problem, then, ooh, mm-hmm. well, maybe we shouldn't associate with you because, you know.
That goes down to the individual. Like, a lot of people are supportive of it, and some people really aren't. They're like, why don't you drink? Like, what?
Right.
Yeah. Right. I mean, that happens.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And I've been fortunate in not having to, you know, even at work when, it was like, okay, I have all the booze, here it is. Or, you know, I was the first one in. We were building a new building. I was the first one in the new classroom with mm-hmm. the champagne and everything else. When I came back, everybody thought I had a mental breakdown, which I did. But when I came back, there wasn't that pressure. Mm-hmm. And there were a lot of new people, so they might not have all realized. Or, you know what, maybe it wasn't all about me and people weren't really paying attention.
Yeah.
Imagine that.
That, yeah. Definitely a possibility.
I actually come to accept that it's not all about me, too. But yeah, it's and that's why for me, educating my own children or people around us, maybe that don't even know that I'm in recovery, just you know that it can be dangerous is really important.
Absolutely.
I'll do it in the ways I can, but yeah.
All right.
Cool.
Well, I think we're all out of questions. You got any more, Eric?
No.
All right. No.
It's great.
Yeah. Great job, Sandra. Everybody, we'd like to thank you for joining us today. We're going to give you a golf clap here. Yay!
Well, thank you for letting me do this. Like I said, it really did help me. Coming up to my 2 years, I'm reflecting a lot. And
yeah, that's huge. Know,
just trying to stay sober one day at a time.
Mm-hmm. And right now we're going to give you one quick minute to say, give a message of hope to anybody out there who's listening, who's struggling with alcohol or drugs. What do you want to say to them to, like, just give them that little extra boost?
So I spent nearly 40 years in a really dark, horrible place for mm-hmm. whatever reason. And you know, I found the way that I would deal with it, and it was with alcohol. Mm-hmm. And it got worse and worse and worse, too. Even though I didn't think of doing anything to myself, it was just, I can't do this anymore. Mm-hmm. Just this fear, just this impending, like, it's all going to just end or just end up horribly. And now my life is so different. I am able to be, I just realized this in the last few months, is that I'm at peace. You know, my whole childhood was about being free and independent, and I'm free of that, the slavery of alcohol. And it has given me such a different life in that I can be present. Mm-hmm. I can cope with difficult situations. There are times when things seem so heart-wrenching and it passes. Mm-hmm. And so with the help of whichever recovery program somebody chooses and having that support system and mm-hmm. being able to learn and grow from it and forgive yourself, it's easy for me to say now.
Yeah.
It truly is. I am grateful every single day for getting the help I needed, being in recovery, and living just an amazing life. You know, I don't need a career that defines me anymore. I completely mm-hmm. left my old career and started something completely different. Mm-hmm. And I can focus on what I love in life. And I feel like I'm actually living life, a productive, happy life. And I wouldn't trade it for anything.
All right. Well, thank you again for joining us. I'm going to sign us out
real quick. Thank you so much.
Absolutely. It was a pleasure. I'm here at Podcast Recovery.
Yes, you guys made this so comfortable.
Good.
Sorry.
Here at Podcast Recovery, we are aiming to expand the scope of support for recovering addicts. Accessibility and convenience of helpful services is paramount to combating addiction. We work to bring the message of recovery to every addict, wherever and whenever it is needed. We believe that a powerful voice of recovery should be obtainable, practical, and at the touch of a button. Every addict deserves to hear a message of hope, and Podcast Recovery is here to provide it. Everybody, thanks for listening. Come join us on Twitter, follow us on Facebook, invite your friends, like, share, retweet, subscribe, all that good stuff. Come join us at podcastrecovery.com. Keep listening, but most importantly, stay safe and stay clean.